Today's show is sponsored by attorney Patrick Dolan from Conti and Dolan and attorney Michael Leonard from Leonard Trial Lawyers. Now, here's John Hansen, and let's get legal.
At 110 on WGN, a very happy, gorgeous Saturday afternoon across Chicagoland. Ooh, that fall crisp temperature is in the air. I certainly like that, although I just heard that we're going to have 80s in the early parts of next week. That's okay. We'll embrace it all as we approach November, our last show of October. And we have Mike Leonard from Leonard Trial Lawyers joining us here on my right. Mike, how you doing, my friend?
Great to be here, John. Doing well.
We go right up to the Northwestern game. I understand you're wearing an Iowa hat, but just remember that this is a Northwestern station, and we say go Cats on this station.
Am I going to get kicked off? Because I say go Hawks, and I still say go Hayden in memory of Hayden Fry.
Okay. I'm just pointing that out. Just that was your one time to say that.
You got a lot of Hawks fans listening to you, John. I got to tell you,
a lot of Blackhawks fans. Hey, Patrick Dolan, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm fine. I'm kind of offended by the Iowa hat. I thought for sure he'd take it off before he came in here,
right before the Northwestern.
Of course.
If Dave Ennett were here, our incredible longtime announcer of Northwestern football, he'd probably shake your hand and be very polite about it.
Well, you know, I went to Wisconsin Law in undergrad, and I don't wear the Wisconsin hat in here.
I went to Illinois, and I don't see three Big Ten boys in here, and only one wearing the hat of an opposing team
brazen.
On the day that they're playing Northwestern.
Sounds like you guys don't have much loyalty to your alma maters. I think the listeners could appreciate loyalty to team and school. Apparently, you guys don't hold that.
Yeah. I'm not going to go into that.
No,
we're playing
the
number one team in the country today, so maybe I should have worn the hat. I guess you're right. Oregon versus Illinois. But we're all looking forward to Northwestern Iowa. That takes place at 2 o'clock will be the pregame show. A couple things to get out of the way before we get into the news of the day. We're going to talk about the Mike Madigan trial briefly. We're going to talk about the Menendez resentencing. We're getting the questions already on the line, talking a little bit more about the Change My Grade lawsuit regarding the use of AI on a paper. So we've got a lot of great questions already coming in. But we have a little announcement to meet. Patrick Dolan and Mike Leonard and myself, if you'll remember last December, we did the trial of the Grinch, and it was heralded and well-reviewed. Still waiting and seeing if we're going to get an Edward R. Murrow Award for it or not, or a Pulitzer or something along those lines, because it was epic. We weighed whether we should maybe re-air it, which we still might do at some point later on as we approach Christmas, but we decided we're going to do a new trial this year. I'll give you guys the date as we get a little closer to it. It will likely be at the end of November or December. And it will be the trial of Mr. and Mrs. McAllister. Kevin McAllister's... It is McAllister, right?
It is.
The parents?
I think so.
In Home Alone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Iridian's nodding. Thank you. We're going to try them on child endangerment. The state has brought charges on child endangerment and neglect. I think a lot of people think it's a slam dunk case. Patrick Dolan, you'll be the prosecutor. I'm sure you think that.
Looking forward to it.
Mike Leonard, I know you're already trying to poke holes in the state's case.
Well, I probably don't have to remind the listeners that we really put a not guilty on so-called Prosecutor Dolan last year. And
a
lot of people are still talking about that.
I don't recall it that way, but okay.
No, well, it was a non-guilty verdict.
Okay, maybe.
But anyways, so in December, likely, we are going to try the Home Alone case, the prosecution against Kevin's parents. And these guys have already started thinking about which witnesses they're going to call, which witnesses we may need from listeners as well. So we might have you, the experts at home, weighing in. And then, of course, at the end of the show, you will all be the jury. So we have that to look forward to.
John, in the spirit of Thanksgiving and Christmas, and just being a good guy, I would suggest that maybe you bring in a second chair to try the case with Patrick after what happened last year. Just an offer by me. I mean, it's just to make it fair.
Maybe his law partner, Karen Conti.
Maybe.
Denied.
You want your chance at revenge.
Yes.
You alone. But it was a good pre-show meeting that we came up with that, and we're all looking forward to that. Okay, let's get to some of the business here, news of the week. Let's start with the Menendez thing, because for people that don't know, although Lisa Dent's been talking about it this week too, everyone really has been. The Menendez brothers, of course, found guilty of murdering their parents, a case in the late or early 90s that lingered into the mid-90s. They were tried twice. The second time, they got guilty verdicts. They've been in prison all this time. There started to be a TikTok trend, and then now recently documentaries and Netflix series showing that there was a lot more than meets the eyes, and there's a different lens of looking at things in 2024 than there were in the mid-90s. And honestly, I thought, okay, that's interesting. There's no way this is going to end up with them out of their jail. But what happened this week, Mike?
So the prosecutor in L.A. announced that he is recommending filing a motion with the court that they'd be resentenced, meaning they would go before the court. The court would consider all the factors in mitigation and aggravation and new evidence, including newly discovered evidence, and decide whether they would be given a lower sentence. What the prosecutor's office is looking for, apparently, is a sentence of life with possibility of parole instead of their current sentence, which is basically life, and with a thought being they would get released. So it's
at
causing,
that moment.
Well, it wouldn't necessarily have to be immediately. The first the first step is they're going to have a hearing just to decide whether there's going to be a hearing to resentence them.
So it's not a done deal just because the prosecutors want it.
Correct. So the judge has to decide, is there a appropriate basis to have a resentencing hearing at all?
Do they usually give deference to a prosecutor if they're the ones coming saying we want a resentencing?
Correct. It would be highly unusual if the prosecutor's office is urging that to happen, that they wouldn't hold the hearing because, you know, there's really no harm. You can at least certainly hold the hearing,
right?
Particularly in a case like this where there's arguing that there's some newly discovered evidence, which courts often like to see as a basis to revisit something.
And I think that's a good thing. Okay, so then there's this hearing. Will the judge be the one to make the determination of the new sentencing?
Correct. So the judge would first decide if they're going to have such a hearing at all. And, of course, you'll have agreement by both parties that there should be such a hearing. And then they'll schedule that and hold that. I would think at this point that would probably be early next year. But it would allow the defense attorneys to introduce evidence, including the fact that someone has come forward who said at around the same time when they were a youth, a minor, they were also sexually abused by one of the parents who was killed. And also, if they've discovered, interestingly, which is legit, a note from months prior to the murders where one of the defendants was writing to a cousin explaining the abuse. And if you go back and look at the tapes of the trial, because it's all available, it's all online, mm-hmm. because that case was taped, he had the prosecutor at the time making some pretty interesting statements that would not be made today, making suggestions that it's not possible for a male to be subject to certain type of sexual abuse by another male, which
obviously
we know is just absolutely absurd.
It's actually absurd that we didn't think that then, to be perfectly honest.
Correct. So there's a lot of reasons why I think a court will want to take another look at it, and I think there are some divisiveness among the public whether this is a really good idea. The family of the brothers who, you know, it was their brother, their sister who were killed, etc., they all support a resentencing. So it'll be interesting. I think most likely they're going to get the hearing to be resentenced, and most likely they're going to get the sentence that the defense wants, and most likely sometime in 2025 they'll be released would be my prediction.
Patrick, have you been following this whole saga?
Yeah, I have, and I remember the trial really well. It's also the second trial when a lot of the child abuse evidence and allegations did not come in. It was a very different... Wasn't allowed, right. It was a very different trial than the first time. But Mike, I have a question for you. So knowing what we know now about the allegations of child abuse, how does that impact the not just the sentencing, but the guilt or innocence of those boys for murdering their parents? What's the impact if the jury would believe that the child abuse occurred, child sexual abuse occurred? What's the impact of that on the charge of murder?
So the way they were charged, it was viewed as a partial defense, meaning, hey, we admit that we did it, but there's these aggravating circumstances. Then the question was, at least in the first trial, was, okay, was the abuse so much? The theory they tried to float in the first trial was the abuse was so sustained and so dangerous and that they had just confronted the parents about it, that they were legitimately fearful of their life, that the parents were going to kill them, which I think was a tough sell.
That's a tough sell.
Very tough sell to make. But under present day laws in California, that would be a defense, the sexual abuse that they could raise, and it might be allow them to get convicted of a lesser charge and get a lesser sentence. So that's how the law has changed in California.
One interesting aspect of this whole thing, and the 815 brought it up, okay, if the father was abusing them, they also murdered their mother.
Correct.
And that, I think, does present the squirreliest part of this case, in a case that has a lot of squirrels. I don't know how I feel about that, and I don't know if the evidence is as strong that it seems more hearsay that the mom knew exactly what was happening versus now we have, you know, evidence of another person saying, yes, this father did this to me too, but does this person say that his wife knew, right? I mean, like, What's the connection to her still?
But I remember, in watching those shows recently that John mentioned that we've all been aired, I remember there was one piece of testimony from one of the boys about the fact that the mother did engage in abuse with regard to him once. So it was not entirely that she knew or didn't know about the abuse that her husband was wreaking upon those boys. So I don't know.
Correct. And the prosecutor who handled the case at the time, who's been interviewed extensively, thought that that was complete, let's say, BS.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
She thought that they had sort of manufactured that allegation to have something to say about the mother's culpability. What's real interesting, though, is they were interviewed back in the day, including by Barbara Walters, which was pretty interesting. And she took a pretty hard-hitting approach with regard to them, as you would expect. They really, sadly, and, you know, probably obviously didn't have much of an explanation. Their explanation seemed to be, gee, we killed our mother because, you know, if the dad was killed, what would she do? She wouldn't really be able to go on. It was really
that's
weak.
But that's not a threat.
It was horribly weak.
Well,
horribly weak. It wasn't saying that we did it because she was in on it. We did it because she knew. It was kind of like, well, she was in bad psychological state, and if her father was killed, gee, what would she do? It was really no explanation at all, and certainly not one that's acceptable to a lot of people, that's for sure.
A lot of people texting in, or excuse me, one person is the 815. There's legit evidence that she was also sexually abusing the boys as well. I haven't seen that.
I mean, that was referenced.
It was referenced. I'd have to go back and look, and I'm a little over my skis in that. I've seen the documentary that you and I talked about. Mm-hmm. I saw the Monsters docuseries,
right. And
I remember bits and pieces. But that's my extensive knowledge of the case. I'm sure there's details that other people have dove into and found that I haven't. I just know that a judge, if they're weighing this whole thing, maybe it isn't as slam dunk as we think it is. I don't know.
No, there's no doubt it's not a slam dunk once you introduce that defense. And the listener makes a good point. There was evidence presented at trial that the mom was involved. That testimony was rather limited, but it's like any type of testimony in these types of cases. I'm not discounting it. It's testimony in any case where a witness says something happened and there's no one to disprove it or to corroborate it necessarily. And so therefore it makes it hard for people to sometimes accept. But of course we know just because there's not a second person who witnessed it or corroborates it, it certainly doesn't mean it didn't happen. That happens all the time, and I'm very familiar with that concept as a defense lawyer.
Mike, what was the reason the judge excluded that evidence in the second trial? Was it relevant, or was it because
they wanted to win?
Well, the judge in the second case took the position that the evidence of the sexual abuse was not relevant because it didn't create an imminent threat to them, that therefore they had to go around and turn around and kill the parents, because there was a kind of an intermediate step in the argument. The argument was, hey, we're being subject to abuse. We think my dad is going to kill us, so we're going to do it first. And so that wasn't sufficient for the judge to find that it was admissible. He didn't go with that chain of logic.
So in California law at the time, in order to argue that self-defense for that lesser charge, you had to show an imminent threat to you. But under California law now, a defense attorney would rightly or probably argue for a lesser charge that now exists because of mitigating factors like abuse.
Correct.
Okay. So it wasn't available back then to these two brothers.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a case where you could talk about all day. Everyone's going to have strong opinions and feelings about it just because of the nature of the crime, of course. And that's understandable. But I think people come down on both sides. But a lot of people come down on the side of, hey, look, if there's newly discovered evidence, why wouldn't a court want to hear it?
100%.
And if we're light years ahead of where we were about our understanding of sexual abuse and how it relates to the court system and to cases. So that's changed monumentally.
Yeah, can I just say, and I know this will be a controversial statement, I try not to make too many of them on WGN. This is just my own personal belief. I respect everyone else's out there. That's a long way to say, this is one more argument in my mind, whether you agree that they should be released or not, of why I think the death penalty is something that is so archaic, and we've had so many exonerations of people on death row that even if there's a morsel of a morsel of a morsel of a chance that someone may not have been guilty of the crime that everyone thinks they committed, that this is why I think the death penalty probably in many cases should not exist, because there's always a fight left for people in certain cases. And I know that that means a lot of people want to see die for crimes that are heinous and horrible, and they absolutely did, will stay alive in jail longer. I recognize that, and that may be unfortunate to some people. But to protect those very few people that would have been put to death if they were not exonerated, makes that a slam dunk argument.
Well,
for me.
I think a lot of people agree with you, and I think my law partner Karen Conti has made a huge point of that over and over again.
And Illinois, probably better than the way I just did.
Yeah, and as we know in Illinois, we don't have the death penalty.
That's right.
Right.
I'm just saying. I know, and maybe that has. I haven't looked at public opinion on the death penalty in a long time. It's actually not something I think about probably all that often because we live in Illinois. Mm-hmm. But and honestly, it's not something that like gets me going every time I hear about an execution around the country. Maybe the most recent one that we had in Missouri where a lot of people were eyes open to that. I didn't read too much about the case, but I know people were riled up about it. It's not an issue that I feel extremely passionate about. But every time I hear about an exoneration or a potential resentence, it brings that up. Patrick, I'm so sorry.
That's
I'll
okay.
give you first go, but I got to take a break.
Go ahead, fine.
And then we got the news coming up, and then we'll have just another half hour left, so we got to get to a couple things quickly. We got to get to Mike Madigan. We got to get to the question about changing grades and AIs on papers, all coming up next after this break, and the news on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association on WGN. Mike Leonard to my right, Patrick Dolan to my left. We were chopping up the Menendez case earlier. And by the way, if you missed any of it and want to go back and hear these guys' opinions of the case, go to WGNradio.com shortly after the show. Already we'll post the interview there and our whole discussion. Patrick Dolan, how is life in the employment law world before we get into some other federal bigger things?
It's good. Busy. People still have questions about non-competes, which it seems like it should go away. The FTC's rule banning non-competes is not law. I don't think it'll ever be law, but I still get questions about, you know, non-competes, and geez, we thought they were no good anymore.
Layoffs still pretty consistently low, or you seen some pickups? Or?
A little bit of pickup, depending on the industry, like, you know, big consulting firms, stuff like that, some ad agencies, some, you know, banks, financial institutions. So it's not a lot worse than I've seen it before, but it has picked up a little bit, I think.
What number can people reach you at with any employment questions?
312-332-7800.
312-332-7800. It's also where you reach Karen Conti for all your family law needs, or if you need someone in for an arm wrestling contest, Karen sure. Conti can handle that
She'll
for you.
She'll beat you.
She will, absolutely. She's got huge biceps. Where was I? Mike Leonard, how are you, buddy? Federal defense attorney. What number can people reach you at, by the way?
312-380-6559. Yeah, this week we were on trial for a couple days in a state court criminal bench trial and just finished with closing arguments yesterday and Friday. So feel
are
like
closing I'm... arguments your favorite part of the trial?
They're one of the most favorite parts. I mean, I love cross-examination, I would say.
Yeah, you
it's
love
just,
that.
A cross is a lot of fun. But, yeah, closing definitely is right up there with cross-examination. I mean, it's just, it's most fun. You know, it's attempting to summarize, not really summarize, but persuade based upon what they've heard, you know, draw the inferences, make the conclusions, make the arguments, take the gloves off. So closing is a heck of a lot of fun.
Do you move a lot when you're giving your closing away from the
I tend
do you
to,
walk
yeah.
around?
I tend to
visualize you in
yeah,
closing.
I tend to walk a bit, and I like to take up certain positions in the courtroom, and I like to have a good distance or come closer. You know, it's theater, you know, so you got to use the courtroom.
I kind of want to watch Mike try a case.
So do I. I'd like to.
Guys, you're welcome.
Can you get
anytime.
Us tickets? Is it StubHub? Is that the best place to go?
Oh, yeah, you got it. You're definitely going to have good tickets.
Probably very
expensive. It's always a sellout, guys. But for you two, I'll let you in. Thanks.
We want a skybox.
Sit at the defense table.
They got great food. They got great food.
With a dessert card and everything. Yeah, we'd love that. No, seriously, I'd love to watch you do it. I think it'd be really fun.
I would love to have you guys.
Let's watch
next time, I'll let you know. I'll let you know for come over for some good action.
But sounds like
good.
You guys coming to the Blackhawks game, I want you at the games where I'm doing the most fun games, right? Where I know I've got something fun going on. So don't give me one of these boring trials, Mike. Give me something juicy. Okay,
I'll give you nothing but juicy. Yeah, you only invite us to the Blackhawks games where you're like taking your shirt off in front of the crowd.
That never happens.
Doing a yard
Thankfully,
of beer
maybe.
Or something like that, John.
Rarely happens.
Rarely. Okay.
Rarely.
Went from never to rarely. Yeah, see right. that, Mike? It was cool.
Yeah. You mentioned that you had closing arguments. Is it in the jury's hand over the weekend?
They're not
deliberating. It was,
yeah, I can't give you too much detail about the case, but because we're not completely done with the case, but we did get a verdict. We got a not guilty on the most important charge for us. It wasn't a complete not guilty, but what we really needed to win, we got that, which was fantastic. And so we still have some proceedings left with that case.
Okay. Well,
good for you.
We'll leave it exactly where that is.
Perfect.
Okay, Mike Madigan, where are we at in that case?
So we had a start to the case this week. We had opening arguments by both sides. The government, you know, showed a little bit, so gave the jury a little meat, a little something to work with. They showed a video of Madigan interacting with former city council member Solis, which they claim was one of the taped conversations that helps the government. They allege demonstrate that Madigan engaged in corrupt activities. The defense lawyers did a very effective job on behalf of Madigan and McLean as painting this as this kind of decades-long attempt to find something on Madigan with never really establishing what they would term a real bribe. So I think that was pretty effective. And then, you know, the trial began, and the government's doing what they need to do early on is kind of setting the table. Number one, to try to show, you know, Madigan's reach, his power, how things work. They also, you know, showed the early stages of the ComEd evidence, you know, that ComEd was allegedly in poor financial circumstances and were eventually given a lifeline, according to the government, by Madigan through the passage of certain legislation, which the government is ultimately going to argue was influenced improperly. So as we've said all along, or at least I've said, John, I think Madigan does have a strong defense. He's got a great team. I think there's a substantial chance of getting a very favorable non-guilty verdict in that case.
And that's with your defense attorney hat on?
That's my Iowa hat and a defense attorney hat.
Still unattractive hat, by the way. Hasn't changed.
We're getting too close to Northwestern football to even mention that school's
name. All I'll say is go Hawks, go Hayden once again.
Okay. Just stick with go Hawks, and then that applies to the Blackhawks.
Blackhawks, right.
And everyone's okay with what you said.
I love that.
I can't do it, John.
We got a question. I haven't got an answer yet from Dave Schluter. I'm sure he's typing up a good one. I know he read the text message, at least that's what my phone told me. Someone has an election-related question. I live from the 608, because I, John Hansen, don't, but this person lives in a gated townhome community. Are the property managers legally required to allow campaign workers or canvassers into the townhome community that's gated? Must they allow them in to knock on doors and drop literature? And what I appreciate about this text is I have no idea whether this person's asking whether they want the workers there or not. And I like that because I'm curious what your guys' take is. I mean, this is private property after all, right?
It is. And I don't think they have a right to go in there and distribute their wares based on private property.
They can't legally be obligated to allow them in, is what you're saying.
No, right, exactly. It's a different way to say the same thing.
Well, a gated community could say, and a board could say, we are allowing canvassers in.
It's private property. Yes, they can make that decision. That's what it seems like to me.
Mike, any worries about that?
I always hate to agree with Patrick on anything,
but I think he
sounds like he might be right. I think the only way that would be a problem is if they let in
one side
and not the other, then there'd be good First Amendment argument. But because it is private property, I don't see that they have an entitlement to go in there. And so I'm going to have to, you know, very reluctantly agree with Patrick's legal analysis.
Thanks, Mike. It's the smartest you've ever sounded.
I think I would have to see, by the way, I'm not a lawyer, so this is the non-lawyer talking.
I thought
talking.
You were, John. You're not a lawyer? Oh, my God.
Here's my thing. You say one side or the other, and I think you're right there. I'll go even a step further. If your policies allow certain people to come in and knock on doors, whether it's religious organizations or along those lines, I think if you've opened that door to allow certain people in or, you know, just people walking, then you have to allow everybody to do it.
Agreed.
Or everyone within a certain reason that's expected, but someone during the daytime, same hours as normal, who presents identification or something along those lines, if you allow, I'm just using a religious group as an example, I have no idea, but if you let them do it, then you should have to allow canvas workers to do it.
I think that's a great point, Patrick. What do you think? Even though he's not a lawyer.
He always sounds like one. I mean, sure, either everybody or nobody. That's the safest way to go.
And we're talking that's a First Amendment sort of thing, right?
Well, I don't know if the First Amendment applies.
Because property rights?
Yeah, no, I don't think so.
Maybe it's a due process claim.
That's probably a better claim. I don't think there's any First Amendment right there.
You're right, because this isn't the federal government
saying it's not a government employer.
Okay.
It's a private property owner.
Look, I mean, I like when people just throw things at us. We've come to an answer we all agree on. Which could be completely wrong.
Exactly, but that's what the show's all about. You know?
We're going to get a text.
We all agree.
We're
going to
get a text
right
very soon
agree.
About a Supreme We're going to get a Supreme Court text soon saying, you guys have no idea what you're talking about.
And I'm going to say that's what Mike said. Mike said that.
And we will delete that text.
and I'll say, I'm not the lawyer, guys. It's you two. Let's take a break then more. Let's get legal powered by the Illinois State Bar Association on WGN. Mike Leonard, I thought of something that I forgot to bring up when you were talking about your recent case, that it was a bench trial. I totally glossed over it and thought, we better come back to this. That was entirely the thought that I had. And I wanted to actually ask, bench trial, so it was just you guys arguing with the judge. Arguing to the judge.
Yeah, correct. So in Illinois state court, you can have a jury trial or you can have a bench trial at your election. You know, so you can make that choice. In federal court, you have to have all parties agree, meaning the prosecution, the defense, and judge all have to agree to a bench trial. In the feds, which really just means the prosecution and defense. The judge isn't going to say, no, I won't have a bench trial.
Right.
So you would take a bench in certain situations, depending on the type of the case. Sometimes you might think, for example, that it's more of a technical defense or a legal issue, and that a judge would be better suited to decide that, take the emotion out of it, and look at it a little more dispassionately. You certainly might also look at the types of rulings the judge is known to give. You know, maybe they have certain leanings or what you perceive to be certain leanings. And sometimes you think that you might have a better chance with the jury. So it's sometimes a difficult question to answer and a choice to make.
Yeah, I can't imagine the feds ever agree. The prosecutor's defense ever agreeing to a bench trial. One side usually wants it, right? And yeah, if I were the other side, I'd be like, I don't want it,
man. It's pretty rare. I mean, in federal court, I've never had one because prosecutors never agreed to one. But
right.
A lot of the times, I wouldn't want one anyway. So
yeah.
You know, we typically would put our hands in the jury more often than we would in the bench in a lot of cases because it's a different standard. You got 12 people. And if we can at least convince one of them, at least we can hang the jury.
Yep.
Or convince all of them and win, get the not guilty.
We got a caller for you, Patrick Dolan. So let's go to David. David, remember never to say the company's name that we're about to talk about, but go ahead.
Absolutely. Can a single entity fire you for health reasons, even though they didn't offer you health benefits?
A company firing you for health reasons, even when they didn't offer you health benefits. Patrick, I bet you have some follow-up questions.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of reasons that could be discriminatory or retaliatory or in violation of federal or state law. It depends on what the health reasons are. If it's protected, if it's a serious health condition that's protected under state or federal law, then no, that would be discriminatory or could be retaliatory if you make a claim for certain health benefits or something. But generally speaking, health issues are not good reasons for terminating somebody.
But if they're not offering health benefits, David, did this happen to you? Or are you speaking about a friend or something?
No, this happened to me.
Were you full time?
Yesterday. Yes, I was.
You were full time and denied health benefits?
Correct. For over a year.
Wait, how big is the company?
Mom and pop.
Mom and pop. So I think there's a threshold of number of employees required for
it actually depends. If he's full time, they should be required to provide health benefits under state law. And so he was fired because.
And you were fired because of a health reason, David?
Correct.
That's what I'm.
I was admitted into the hospital for health reasons.
Okay, so that shouldn't even matter about health benefits.
That has nothing to do with health benefits, yeah. So if you were admitted into the hospital for a health reason, that's probably protectable under federal or state law. And so if they terminate you because of that absence, that's illegal. That's what I was focused on.
Yeah, the health benefits thing, that's a whole other thing.
No, that's totally. But his better claims are discrimination for being terminated for that reason.
And you worked for a year there, David, you said, right?
Over a year, yes.
I mean, he should have get FMLA,
how many employees?
Right?
How many employees? That's, you know.
There's probably 10 employees total, but they're under different categories.
Yeah.
That's okay, but under state law, probably versus federal law, you have some protections. Federal law and the FMLA, you have to have 50-50 employees in order to have the Family Medical Leave Act requirements apply to a company. But state law is much more favorable and protects employees who work for small employers.
David, did they tell you they fired you for your health reasons?
Correct.
They said that.
I was going to say the answer is going to be no for
sure.
Well,
then you need to, David, call Patrick Dolan on Monday. This is the exact kind of person you want calling,
yes,
right?
Yes, of course.
David,
happy to help.
Do you have his number?
No, I do not.
All right, I'm going to say it a couple times and just write it down. 312-332-7800. 312-332-7800. Rudy, why don't we put him on hold and you just make sure he got that, because we're running out of time and I don't want to miss this break. This was great stuff. We are out of time. Mike Leonard, how can people reach you? Why should they be reaching you?
Any sort of federal or criminal, state alleged criminal violation or investigation, and 312-380-6559.
Patrick, someone like David is the person that should be calling you. And I was just going to say, we often think that, oh, our company knows the rules and laws. They're not doing anything wrong. And maybe they weren't in this case. But especially small businesses often don't. And they make mistakes.
Yeah, but I would have nothing to do if everybody did the right thing.
That's a great point. How do people reach out to you?
312-332-7800.
And say it one more time.
312-332-7800.